I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. On this edition of Parallax Views. In 1965 and 66, massacres occurred in Indonesia. It was a coup, a changing of the guard that saw an overnight shift in regards to those who held power within Indonesia's leadership. And it was all supported by movers and shakers in Washington, D.C. Many questions linger regarding the Indonesian massacres. What does it all mean? Vincent Bevins, author of the stunning new book, The Jakarta Method, Washington's anti-communist crusade and the mass murder program that shaped our world, doesn't necessarily provide all the answers in a neat little package, but his investigation should shake anyone who reads it to their core and have them rethinking 20th century history and the world we have inherited from that century. Bevins, who has written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Financial Times, and the Los Angeles Times, joins us to discuss this important new book. And I believe that it is really an understatement to even say important. This is a book you need to read. In my view, it will be one of the best books, if not the best book, on historical matters to be published in 2020. It is a story of the Cold War, the CIA, the Third World, and horrors of an unspeakable nature. The full picture of what Vincent Bevins calls the Jakarta Method still eludes us to this very day. But the pieces of the puzzle which we have obtained raise startling questions. So with that being said, let's get right into the conversation with Vincent Bevins, author of The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade, and the Mass Murder Program that Shaped Our World. But first, a word from our sponsor.
My name is Joseph L. Flatley, and I'm a journalist who specializes in conspiracy theories and French culture. Over the years, I've met cultists and occultists, flat earthers, and doomsday bunker salesmen, to name only a few. One thing I hear often is that the end of the world is near, and these days, you have to wonder if there might be some truth to that. My new podcast is called Failed State Update. Through interviews and original reporting, each episode asks the question, is the world ending, or does it just seem like it is? Think of it as fresh air for the Orwellian dystopia we've suddenly found ourselves in. Available now on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Parallax Views. Vincent Bevins, author of the new book. I've been very excited about this book for quite a few months now. The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program That Shaped Our World. That is a mouthful for a title. Vincent, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm okay. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Pretty good, pretty good. I want to really dive into the meat of this book. But first, if we could, I wanted to talk a little bit about Brazil, which comes up a lot in this book. And one of the things that really stood out to me was the fact that you were there for the rise of Bolsonaro, who is now coming under a lot of scrutiny. And there's one interaction in the early stages of the book that really stood out to me between you and Bolsonaro. Maybe we could talk about that and just seeing the rise of this fanatical anti-communism in Brazil.
Yeah, I mean, I'm here now. I'm in Sao Paulo now. That wasn't exactly the plan. But when this global pandemic hit and I couldn't do the book tour, I just stayed in downtown Sao Paulo. So, yeah, I mean, he's very much hanging over my life now again. But, yeah, I first spoke with him the day that Dilma Rousseff was impeached in 2016. And so I got to Brazil in 2010 to cover the rise of an emerging powerhouse on the global stage for the Financial Times. And under Lula and then Dilma, Brazil was probably the most successful social democratic experiment ever undertaken in a large developing country. And that was sort of the day that it all started to fall apart. And I met him in the hallways before he and other Congress persons, but mostly congressmen, voted to remove her. And I asked him, "Oh, I'm from the international press," I said. "So I want to ask you about the way this will look around the world. Don't you think that the world might look upon this impeachment as a less than a legitimate process?" Because it was fairly clear to everyone at the time, and I'd written about this, that Dilma Rousseff was accused of almost nothing compared to the things that the people voting to remove her had actually done. And he said, no, the world will rejoice that we're removing Dilma today because it's going to stop us from becoming North Korea. And this was such vintage Cold War fire and brimstone that I didn't even use in the piece. It was like, oh, well, that's off the far right spectrum. It's off the charts, right? Like,
well, Rousseff's like a center left leader, right?
So in her childhood, she was a guerrilla. But I mean, as she governed Brazil in the center left Workers' Party, if she was guilty of anything, it was giving away too much money, probably to large corporations. It was absolutely ridiculous to make this comparison. But that strand of anti-communist fanaticism, this violence that is ready to be unleashed on any real or potential eruption from below, never went away in Brazilian politics. And then 2 years later, he was elected, and now he's running the country that I'm in right now.
So how is it, I'm sorry to interrupt, how is it that a far-right candidate can still, in a place like Brazil, the unenlightened reader, how is it that that kind of rhetoric still carries any kind of sway?
Can I add something to that real quickly, Casey?
Yeah, go for it.
There's this character that I think Bolsonaro has actually referenced, and I'm probably botching his name, but Olavo de Carvalho, who, as far as I understand, he's just a sort of wacky astrologist that has reinvented himself as like a traditionalist, anti-communist philosopher of Brazil for the Brazilian conservatives. And yet he's, not even in Brazil. I think he's in Virginia. Wonder often how these people get to where they are.
Olavo de Carvalho, that was like pretty good pronunciation. He is the guru for the new Brazilian right, and he says he's a philosopher. He's really probably a YouTuber. He's a online provocateur, a hard right anti-communist, conspiracy theorist, certainly. And he was always there. And I think that's the answer. The other question: this never went away, right? So the entire time that Lula and Dilma were running a very mature and respected social democratic center left administration, you still had reaction just below the surface in Brazil. It never went away. You know, the democracy is only 25 years old or so, now 30, I guess. And when that impeachment blew a hole in the center of Brazilian politics, Bolsonaro walked in. Now, that wasn't the plan. The center-right forces that united to also impeach Rousseff, they thought that they would benefit. That did not happen. What happened is that the two of you may remember a president named Michel Temer, who was running Brazil for a couple of years in the wake of that impeachment. He was wildly unpopular. Like, his approval rating was sometimes like 2% plus or minus 3%, if that makes sense. Like, it was statistically negative at points, his approval rating. And with the destruction of the center right as a result of that impeachment, this guy who had been standing on the far, far right walked into the center, and because he had been so irrelevant for so long, he was able to claim, partially credibly, that he was not a part of the political system. The reason he wasn't part of it is because no one wanted him to invite him to any of the meetings. He wasn't big enough to be corrupt enough to be brought down by the corruption investigations that kind of dominated politics in the last 5 years. But I think that that's an important thing to understand about South America. Like, these top-down waves of reactionary violence have been a part of Latin America's history ever since European people came, committed genocide against the natives, and then imported slaves from Africa. And I think, I mean, we'll probably get to this much later, but this was a commonality, I think, between North American and South American anti-communism, which didn't really map so easily onto Asia. Like, when U.S. officials got to Latin America during the Cold War, they found that the white elites here felt very similarly about things. They found that they could really get along with the white elites in Brazil, and the white elites in Brazil were also always afraid of the descendants of enslaved people rising up against them. And they had this sort of idea of liberty, which was based on, you know, property for me, that was very that made a lot of sense in North and South America. And when they went to Southeast Asia with the same kind of thinking, it just didn't make sense at all. When they tried to bring this kind of thinking to countries that are not settler colonies, to countries where everyone is sort of considered full citizens in ways that I think that in Western Hemisphere we do not extend to our populations, they kind of hit a brick wall.
And Brazil is I'm sorry to interrupt, but Brazil is especially a salient case, I think, because of the sheer number of chattel slaves imported over the course of the transatlantic slave trade, and just the sheer length of time, like the manner in which emancipation occurred and how late it did,
exactly
kind of highlight the racial dynamics at play and why it maps so well with American foreign policy.
Exactly. I mean, it's the same. I mean, people really underestimate the extent to which the countries are similar, right? And when I met Inge, who's one of the characters in the book, the way that she described Brazil as such an outsider, like, really helped it gel for me. She said she got to school and she's like, oh, okay, this is a country where they speak a language that's from Europe, even though this isn't Europe. White people are in charge. Just below that, there's another class of people that are allowed to sort of hang out with white people. That's me. Below that are black people. And then below that are indigenous people. And, like, that is also the dynamic we have in the United States. We just have different proportions, right? Like, the United States is run by white people that descend from colonizers and speak a Western European language. Then there are later groups of immigrants that have almost as much as power, not as much. There are formerly enslaved, the descendants of formerly enslaved peoples, and then the victims of genocide. The only thing that's different is the proportions.
You know, before we get into what happened in Indonesia, I think we have to go a little bit backwards in time. The aftermath of World War II, it sort of sees, you know, the British Empire is gone. Now you have the two superpowers. You have on one hand the U.S. and you have on the other the Soviet Union. And most people think of the Cold War in those terms, although there's also this Third World Movement. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And also afterwards about how figures like J. Edgar Hoover looked at communism and their sort of fanatical anti-communism.
Right. So although the term is kind of come into disrepute in recent decades because of the way that racists use it in the United States, I found the distinction between first, second, and third world is pretty useful. So broadly speaking, at the end of World War II, you had three groups of countries. There was the countries that had been imperialist, that had somehow or another controlled other countries directly. This is Western Europe, the United States, and Japan. You had the second world, which was the Soviet Union and the countries that it had occupied in World War II, so Central and Eastern Europe. And then you had the rest of the world, which is the vast majority of humanity. And these countries, largely speaking, got their independence in the first years after World War II. Sometimes they had to fight for it, in the cases of Vietnam or Indonesia. But by the early 50s, they had emerged onto the world stage. And the concept of the third world was not that they would be less than, is that they would be the new wave of humanity that would take its place in human history. And this was a very optimistic project. And the people that I met that remember what this was like, the way their faces change when they talk about this vision. Their eyes light up with this idea of what the world would be once the formerly colonized peoples were given the position that they deserved.
A hope for a better world, in other words.
Yeah, and it was not only a hope, it was like they believed it would happen. It seemed obvious, right? We're not colonies anymore. We're obviously as smart as them. We have natural resources. Once we are no longer under the yoke of imperial rule, direct imperial rule, I should say, we'll be able to form a new world. And to a very large extent, this was a movement which thought that capitalism was a white European thing. Capitalism was very much wrapped up in the idea of colonialism. So in Indonesia, for example, in the period of the anti-colonial struggle, if you were a socialist, you were an anti-colonialist, and vice versa. They assumed that there would be some kind of a new economic system they would create which was less exploitative. And at the same time, you have in the United States the outbreak of what we ended up calling McCarthyism. And in the United States after World War II, the elites there knew how to deal with the Second World. They decided that they were going to confront the Soviet Union. After the quote-unquote loss of China in 1949, they decided to crack down on the left in the United States. But nobody in the CIA, certainly, and I think in the larger political establishment in general in the United States, understood what the Third World was or how to deal with it. There were small amounts of people that had an idea, that had been there, that had traveled abroad. But this idea, this fanatical anti-communism that J. Edgar Hoover lays out at the time ends up being extended. Well, yeah, I mean, I could just read even what he says, if that works. He says that he said that communists were always planning to organize a military revolt, which would always culminate in the extermination of police forces and the seizure of all communications. And he said, one thing is certain, the American progress, which all good citizens seek, such as old age security, houses for veterans, child assistance, and a host of others, is being deployed as window dressing by the communists to conceal their true aims and entrap gullible followers. The numerical strength of the party's enrolled membership is insignificant. For every party member, there are 10 others ready, willing, and able to do the party's work. There is no doubt as to where a real communist loyalty rests. Their allegiance is to Russia. So he set a trap. Right? It's a perfectly functional, logical death trap where if you're doing anything that is just remotely reformist, then you're only doing that to hide that you're really a communist.
Right. You're still a commie even if you just want reforms, even if you're not a communist. No matter what you do,
Exactly. If you're being a communist, then you're being a communist. But if you're not, it's because you're hiding being a communist. And if there's a lot of you, then there's a lot of you, which is a problem. But if there's not a lot of you, then there's definitely a lot of you, which is even worse problem, right? And this kind of logic, it's very well understood in the English-speaking world that this was applied to domestic liberals in the United States in a way which is like more or less seen as a bad thing, these days, but it's far less understood the ways that this exact same kind of logic was mapped onto entire parts of the world where the U.S. foreign policy establishment had much less regard for human life.
Now, in this regard, when we talk about the Third World Movement, I guess the thinking of a Hoover or some of these more extreme figures within the U.S. establishment is they're all secretly controlled by the Soviet Union. There's also another side of this that says, I think there's a thing called the Jakarta Axiom that right. recognizes that this movement, this Third World Movement, isn't necessarily aligned with the Soviet Union at all times.
Exactly. So under Truman, it was not clear exactly how you would deal with quote unquote neutral countries. They knew they didn't like it, but they thought that perhaps you could deal with it as long as communists were sufficiently repressed. So in 1948, while the Indonesian independence forces are still fighting off the Dutch, there's this power struggle between the left and the right of the independence movement, and the right ends up winning and crushing the PKI, the Indonesian Communist Party, in during the Revolutionary War, essentially. And that... in Washington is seen as the axiomatic case of a country that was neutral enough, neutral in the right way that it could be tolerated. Now, two things happen in Indonesia which change the situation entirely. When Eisenhower takes over, 1953, neutralism is out. Under Eisenhower and the quote-unquote successes of the early CIA overthrowing governments in Iran in 53 and then Guatemala in 54, neutralism is seen as one, a threat, and two, that's something that can be fixed with this new shiny tool that has been created, which is the Central Intelligence Agency. So not only is neutralism out anyways, in Indonesia, the Communist Party, which had been seen as sufficiently repressed during the War of Independence, was participating in elections because there was a multi-party democracy in Indonesia, and they were doing better and better. And of course, we know now from records that Nixon said that democracy is probably the wrong type of government for Indonesia because the communists are the best at it. So by the middle of the 50s, not only is neutralism over, not only is the Communist Party doing better and better, Sukarno puts on the Bandung Conference, which is the first ever meeting of in the opening speech, which you can watch on YouTube, he says this is the first ever meeting of the so-called colored peoples in the history of the world, and it's bringing together billions of the world's peoples to sort of really cement this Third World Movement as an actual thing, with an actual project, with actual international exchanges and mechanisms that will move this project forward. And by then, the Jakarta axiom is out. The Indonesian left is a real problem in Washington, and the Eisenhower administration sets that new gang of blue blood Yale boys, the CIA, to work to try to crush Indonesia.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the Iran coup, which I believe was Operation Ajax, and there's also the Guatemala coup, and one thing that stood out to me was, first off, the leader of Guatemala during that time was not really much of a communist, and yet he was seen as unacceptable. Colonel Diaz takes over for him, and there's a point in the book where you go over a conversation that Diaz had with one of the CIA station chiefs. And the right. station chief says, "You made a big mistake when you took over the government. Colonel, you're just not convenient for the requirements of American foreign policy." And he yep. basically says, "You're going to have to kill all these Guatemalans. They need to be shot immediately." And Diaz right. says, "But why?" "Because they're communists," is the response.
Right, right. And that was N.O. Hobbing, by the way, a former journalist for Time magazine who had switched to the agency, which was something that happened fairly often in the early days of the CIA. And you're absolutely right. So Jacobo Arbenz was at best a liberal reformer, right? And what he said in his inauguration speech, and he wasn't lying, is that he wanted to bring Guatemala from feudalism to capitalism, that he wanted to put in place the basic reforms that would make sort of that would allow the free market to work. Of course, the Guatemalan Communist Party was very important and influential, again, because they were very well organized and they had been active in the country for a long time. But he could easily have been a Republican in the United States. Like, but what was the problem with Arbenz? Number one, his land reform policy was going to directly take on United Fruit, which was extremely well connected in Washington. Number two, just the idea of having a reformist government in Central America was seen as very dangerous to the State Department. And we know now from declassified files, the danger was not that there would be a Soviet encampment in our backyard. The danger was not that they would ruin the economy. The danger was not that they would eventually somehow threaten the United States. The danger was that they would set an example to other countries in the region if they were seen as successful. And so all these things come together. A lot of times there's debates as to, well, what really powers U.S. interventions? Is it bare economic profit motives? Is it blood for oil? Or is it the exaggerations and paranoia of geopolitical goals like anti-communism or anti-terrorism or whatever? And I think that these things, that doesn't have to be a binary, right? I think
it's,
if you have one,
or.
Exactly. If you have both, it's probably going to happen, right? If you have one, it might. But if you get these things working together, as they did in Guatemala, then it's probably going to happen. And like the way that the Arbenz coup happened, we kind of reset history after World War II, and I do even in the book. But like, if you're a leader of Central America, you know that if like the Marines might be coming, you got to go. And so Arbenz, even though Che Guevara, who was in Guatemala at the time, and other people on the left told Arbenz not to give in, that he had to fight because the consequences would be too grave if he gave in to this sort of fairly obviously slapdash coup. Right? Like, it wasn't, Arbenz didn't think that the invasion was going to succeed, but Arbenz knew the U.S. was behind it. So eventually eventually you can't stick around. But when he agreed to leave, agreeing to pass over power to that colonel that you decided, but then the U.S. came in and said, no, actually, the country's going to custody arm us, our man, who we've been arming. And there's nothing you can do about it. And there wasn't, he was right. Like, they did have to do what the U.S. said, and they did. And in Guatemala, if you go there to this day, the long tail of that intervention is very obvious.
Well,
I'm sorry. You mentioned very late in the book that during interviews, you'll ask people, when did democracy die in Guatemala? And their response is nearly universal, 1954.
Yeah, it's not controversial. And people remember what happened. I mean, one guy that I met, Miguel, I don't want to try to reproduce his last name, but he remembers the bombing of, he was on the way to school having breakfast and the bombs were dropping on Guatemala City. And he was terrified, and the memory was seared into his brain forever. And like, this is ancient history for us in the United States, but like, I'm from Los Angeles, like, what if Moscow had bombed LA in 1954? Would my family have forgotten that? It's not a long time ago if it's that traumatic of a historical break.
Now, what I was going to say is that the reason we talked a little briefly here about the Guatemalan coup and Operation Ajax, the coup in Iran, is because these are almost precursors to what comes later. Before we get into that, I think the last thing we need to cover before we dive knee deep into Indonesia is there's two figures that are pretty central to this book that work with the agency. And one is a guy named Smiling Jones, and the other is Frank Wisner and his gang of weirdos, and they are two very, very different people from very different backgrounds, it seems like.
Right, and Frank Wisner is the father of CIA covert operations. So like everybody else that was in the early CIA, he's a blue blood. His blood wasn't quite as blue as most of the guys in there, because most of them were in like Yale secret societies. But as you might have noticed in the book, like he grew up in the part of the South that, you know, he, as a child, he did not dress himself. His black maid put his clothes on for him. And he was a real, true, dyed-in-the-wool cold warrior. He believed that you had to fight communism everywhere, no matter what. And he put that, even in the CIA, people were like, this guy really is really intensely committed to fighting quote-unquote communism.
I think William Colby, even at one point, who helped head up the Phoenix program, said that, Wisner is going a little bit unhinged.
Oh, well, he did go – he went unhinged later. I mean, he ended up very much losing his mind. But even when he was sort of more lucid earlier, his CIA colleagues were like, yeah, this guy's really, really intense about communism. So – and then you have Howard Jones, who I think is kind of your like do-gooder American. He like really wants to help the world, and he joins the State Department. He is very proud of his work as a journalist early in his life, where he takes on the KKK, and even though causes him a professional black eye, he's glad that he does it. And when he joins the State Department after World War II, he's the kind of guy that does not see the world in black and white. He gets to a certain Asian country and he goes and he talks to everyone, including the so-called enemies of the United States. And he wants to know what Indonesia's really like, or he wants to know what Taiwan's really like. And he's trying to always tell the guys back in Washington, like, no, like, this country's different than that other country. And if you try to map your own prejudices onto this country, it's not going to work. Even the quote-unquote enemies of America in Indonesia, for example, saw in him kind of like a good-natured goofball that wanted to do good. And these guys end up developing very different approaches to what was the most important the most important Cold War confrontation after China in the 50s, which was Indonesia.
And it's interesting how there you have in some ways, an accidentally complementary approach to regime change, even if Jones in this case is very unintentionally involved.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way that it tragically plays out, is that the on-the-ground insights, the sort of robust analysis of the situation that he gains from being sort of trusted in a very tragic way is put to use in a manner that I imagine he was horrified to find out about, right? So maybe in 1958, these two men end up going to war on accident, because in 1958, the CIA bombs Indonesia. And this is their second attempt to try to stop the rise of the left in Indonesia. The first is that they pay off a lot of politicians in a right-wing conservative Muslim party, hoping that they'll win elections, and they don't. The PKI, the Indonesian Communist Party, is just doing better and better. In 1958, there is an aerial operation launched over Indonesia, where CIA pilots bomb the country in the attempt to assist some regional rebellions turn into a full-scale civil war that'll break the country into pieces. Now, Jones doesn't know this. He's just been made ambassador. The reason he is made ambassador is so that the ambassador would not know what is happening. So he's having meetings with Sukarno and the foreign minister, Subandrio.
And Sukarno at this point is the leader of Indonesia.
Yes, exactly. So Sukarno is the man who brings together all the independence forces at the end of World War II and ends up being sort of the founding father of the nation, organizing the Bandung Conference. He's very often not a good administrator. He's often not a great president at a technocratic level, but he's the prophet of Indonesian identity. He's beloved as the man that sort of created Indonesia as an idea. And Jones doesn't know the CIA is bombing the country, but the Indonesians have a good idea. And when one of the pilots crash lands on the island of Ambon and is caught, everybody that had assumed the worst about America, and this is the Indonesian left and parts of the center as well, are all proven right. So the CIA, in trying to recreate the successes of 1953 and 1954, they fail very badly in Indonesia, and they're caught and they're humiliated. And Howard Jones has to sort of deal with this, right? He has to apologize and say, I didn't know, and convince the people back in Washington to change tactics. And they do change tactics. He convinces them, after having several conversations with the Indonesian military, with the Indonesian people, that actually the thing to do is not to go to war with the Indonesian armed forces. The thing to do is to become best friends with them and try to establish control or sort of ideological hegemony within the armed forces. Let's be their friends. Let's train them. Let's back them. They're anti-communist, or at least they're the closest thing to anti-communist in Indonesia. Let's get them on our side. And that's exactly what happened. And they start to bring thousands of members of the Indonesian armed forces to train in Kansas. And that's the sort of that his approach, the Smiling Jones approach, remains dominant from 1958 to 1964. And because people are listening to him when he says, no, it's fine. Just back the army, be friends with Sukarno. There's no reason for a conflict here. It's fine. This country is nationalist in the sense of wanting their independence, but they're not a threat to the U.S. Just it's fine. And
he sees the anti-colonial struggle as not having to be necessarily communist in nature, in other words.
Exactly. He's very proud of the fact that he's able to hammer home to the people back in Washington that there's a difference between communism and third world neutrality, third world anti-colonial independence. And the one man in American politics who is saying the same kind of things in the late 1950s is John F. Kennedy. And so when John F. Kennedy is elected in 1960, Sukarno is overjoyed because Sukarno recognizes that Kennedy is the one guy in America that says that the third world has a right to its own destiny. Because in the late 50s, JFK had spoken out against France's involvement in Algeria. JFK had traveled the world and got to know a lot of the leaders of the third world movement, a lot of them in sort of ridiculous and hilarious ways. They had sort of given him like lectures about how stupid the American attitude towards the third world was, but he had gotten these talking to's from Nehru in India and others like him, and he understood what was going on. Now, when Kennedy actually takes over, everything changes very quickly because the Bay of Pigs blows up in his face. And very quickly, Kennedy, I believe, this is speculation, but the way I sort of present it is that he realizes what happens if you're the president of the United States and what you have to deal with, not only from your covert operations people, because the execution of Lumumba, which was not exactly done by the CIA, but it was, happened while he was taking office. Right after he takes office, the Bay of Pigs explodes, and he flips very quickly. He flips from being somebody that is advocating for third world self-determination to just one of the most enthusiastic cold warriors and users of the covert operations apparatus in the 20th century.
Now, to give an idea, when we talk about Wisner and this gang of weirdos and the covert operations side of this, just how, dark does that rabbit hole get, this covert operations? It seems like it can get pretty intense. Stay Behind Networks, I believe, are also involved in all of this stuff.
Yeah, so the one of the very early things that they did in Europe, and this is before they realized that like they weren't very good at Europe, they organized whoever they could get from Eastern Europe that would into these groups that would be in theory supposed to stopping in a potential invasion of Western Europe, but they ended up being sort of far right paramilitary groups that did all kinds of very horrible things. Operation Gladio is the most common name for what ends up coming out of that throughout the second half of the 20th century. And of course, there is all of the mind control experiments. So MK Ultra, the attempt to use LSD to see if minds could be controlled, involved the kidnapping of unsuspecting Americans for experiments. The man who oversaw MKUltra was the same man that came up with the poison that was supposed to murder Patrice Lumumba, the first leader of the Congo. That operation ended up fizzling, and they found a different way to have him killed. But, I mean, if you – there's you couldn't imagine a worse set of operations, right? I mean, it was really – The activities of the covert operations of the CIA in the 1950s are the kinds of things that you would be called insane for making up, right?
There's one point I think you bring up in the story where Wisner tries to convince leftists in the Philippines that an aswang or a vampire is killing people.
You're gonna go with that, not the porno.
I mean, yeah, there's a Carno porno tape. I mean, we can't get into all of it, but some of these ideas are like, Keystone Cops of the CIA almost.
Well, this
poison
is
poison cigars and stuff. It's amazing.
Yeah, so it's like it's a weird. It's funny and it's not because so the Hucks were a Filipino force that refused to stand down after the end of World War II. They were sort of a left. Leaning militia that you could compare maybe to like Greece is a good example. Well, yeah, Greece is a very good example because in both countries, the U.S. Organized counterinsurgency operations to make sure that the country went back into the hands of the people they wanted it to go to, not into the hands of the people that actually fought the fascists. So as part of their psychological, I mean, they were so excited about this stuff, but as part of their psychological warfare tactics that they invented and thought were so spectacularly effective, they took a Huck, drained the blood out of his body, put like a hole in his neck so it would look like he had had his blood sucked by a vampire, and then spread the rumor in the villages that, oh, no, this is proof that the spirits are against them. And I mean, I don't know enough about the Filipino context to know if like people believe this or if people just were terrified by the insanity of the United States. Because I know that in Vietnam, and this is something I did some work on, an art project in Vietnam, they did psychological warfare where they played a horrible tape, of ghosts talking from beyond the grave to Vietnamese soldiers. And the message was, you know, give up or else you're going to haunt the world forever. Like we are, it's a horrible tape you can listen to. And the way that I understand it is not exactly that Vietnamese people thought this was a real – these were really ghosts talking to them. But it was just like a horrible, awful, evil thing that the enemy was doing to mess with them. And it worked to demoralize them for that reason. But yeah, I mean it's like – it's this combination of insanely half-cocked and stupid plans. But then – when they work or even when they don't, it's like what you're trying to destroy the psyche of a nation, right? Like the porno story, which we might as well do, like when they couldn't get rid of Sukarno in the late 50s, they came up with a plan to assassinate him, but they didn't go forward with it. They also had a tape made in Los Angeles that Bing Crosby and his brother Larry produced. There was supposed to be a sex tape that was supposed to expose that Sukarno was not only sexually deviant, but that he had slept with a KGB agent and was therefore compromised by Russia. And they didn't release it. And it's like, it's ridiculous. It's insane. They, you know, there's like wigs and there's a Mexican actor. They're trying to get look Asian. But like, if you think about it, it's like, that's not like they're trying to destroy the founding father of a country because they don't understand. They think he might be an enemy of the United States somehow. So they're like, oh, let's just, you know, let's like humiliate and traumatize an entire nation psychologically because that might get them on our side in the Cold War.
Well, it's interesting too, because I believe some of these leaders, I don't know if It was Sukarno in particular, maybe at the Bandung conference. But there were leaders in this Third World movement that would actually make appeals to U.S. ideas about freedom. And yet this is all ignored by the Wisners of the world who, you know, they think they're the good guys, right? I like how you point out that Frank Wisner views himself as a patriot. He's doing the right thing, but he's such a fanatical ideologue that he's willing to destroy entire nations.
Yeah. And no, I'm glad you brought that up. The way that we portray the Cold War is a battle between equals, and it's portrayed that the communists are the provocateurs. Both of those things are wrong. The United States was far more powerful than the Soviet Union at every point during the Cold War. Often the conflict was actually with the Third World, who was far weaker than even the Soviet Union and its allies. And everybody else in the world, from the Soviet Union to the people, to the Third World Communist parties, to the Third World Social Democratic parties, were all very afraid of provoking the United States. Everybody tried to get along with the United States. So Ho Chi Minh, in his Declaration of Independence, he reproduces the U.S. Declaration of Independence in 1945. He wants the United States to think of him as following in the revolutionary tradition of the North Americans, because he doesn't want to go to war with the most powerful country that's ever existed. In Bandung in 1955, in a very almost pathetic way, they look on the calendar for the date that they have set the conference for, and they find something from the U.S. revolutionary tradition that they can say, oh, no, actually, it's like you. And what they found on that date was Paul Revere's ride. Even Mao, after the victory of the Chinese communists in 1949, which, by the way, Stalin didn't want to happen because he, again, he was not, his stance in the immediate Cold War, the immediate post-war years, even though he's, of course, you know, willing to commit horrible atrocities whenever they serve him, he did not want to provoke the United States in this period. But when Mao took over, he was hoping that there would be a good relationship with the United States. This is absolutely not the case of, you know, and if you think about it for 2 seconds, it makes sense. You know, like, no matter how hard-headed or revolutionary someone might be in Indonesia or Vietnam or Cuba or whatever, why are you going to pick a fight with the United States? And across the board, they never really wanted to. I mean, you have rare exceptions, which are probably pretty well known, but Sukarno, Ho Chi Minh, I mean, especially Sukarno, I mean, at least Ho Chi Minh knew it was probably not going to work. Sukarno believed and hoped that he would maintain good relations with the United States. And he did under Howard Jones until John F. Kennedy is killed.
Now, that's going to bring us to the shift away from what could be called the Jones method with LBJ. But one thing I want to note about Howard Jones is it's interesting the gambit he makes of, you know, we can work with Indonesia and it doesn't need to be this, you know, nightmare thing. And, you know, let's just side with the army. And it sort of creates, I think it creates the groundwork for what could be called, as you put it in the book, the state within the state.
Right. If I may also build on that too, how do the civic action program, how does that factor into this collusion between CIA interests and the Indonesian army?
Well, I want, if Vincent could, maybe you could explain that idea of the state within the state and how Jones sort of contributes to this.
Yeah, so it's not new. It's not the first, you know, this is not an import to Indonesia in 1958. The Indonesian army had always sort of played some kind of a role in the post-war or the post-revolutionary era. But in Washington, officials had been looking around the world and seeing that to modernize, quote unquote, countries had to make this big jump from sort of backwards to modern. And we're in modern in this schematization is just being like America. And so modernization theory often posited that you needed to get some kind of group to do this. And in the Third World, the military was good. And, you know, they could be a reliable way to do this. So 1958, the shift that Howard Jones makes possible is based on not going, you know, just kind of barging in and going to war with the army and hoping you can break the country into pieces, but finding elements that already exist within it and nurturing them. So when you train all of these Indonesian military officers in Kansas, they get trained in this way of thinking, that the army can play a big role in the country, that they can have an economic role, that they can basically be a shadow government, if not a government. And the Civic Action Program, and it ends up being kind of a shadow government. So they had already gotten huge amounts of power as a result of the CIA invasion. This was sort of the very ironic thing, is that the CIA invasion granted the army much more powers, because there was an emergency, state of emergency declared. They ended up taking a lot of local control around the country. They had, their prestige had been,
This already
happens when the Wisner method is being employed, is that they get more power as a result of this civil war. And then Jones turns around and says, no, let's grab this thing and nurture it. And so from 1958 to 1954, especially with the arrival of the Kennedy administration, because the Kennedy brothers are very into counterinsurgency doctrine, they're very into military-led modernization theory. This is something that is put into place all throughout Latin America at the same time. The military is trained to be a shadow government, dual power, you might want to put it, and potentially the government. Now, there are splits in the Indonesian military that Howard Jones's memoirs reveal, that there are people in the Indonesian military that say, no, we should never do this. So Nasution, one of the main partners of the United States in this era, he says, we'll never do like a Latin America dictatorship. That's not what we do. Other elements in the Indonesian military are more amenable to this state within a state project. But what you have, and I think it's important for me to stress that, like, the reason I'm being slightly vague about what the civic action programs are is because they're still declassified. We still do not know exactly what was actually happening under the tutelage of the U.S. military from 1958 to 1965. I called the CIA and I asked them to tell me, but unsurprisingly, that did not work. But it is creating dual power almost. And Sukarno, who was very brilliant as a sort of philosopher of Indonesian identity, as I said, perhaps did not understand the instability that was inherent in the political system that he was overseeing from 1959 to 1965. And this is a period in which the election stopped. So the election stopped after the CIA invasion.
And it's basically Sukarno and the communists versus the West and the army is sort of the narrative, right?
There are many parties that are allowed to participate in quote-unquote guided democracy in 1959, but as the years go on, it's like, no, these are the two poles, and Sukarno stands above them. It is on the right, you have the U.S.-backed army. On the left, you have the unarmed Indonesian Communist Party, which, even though they would win elections if there were any, and everybody knows this, they are aware that their position in society relies on Sukarno's blessing. So they support Sukarno very fully. Instead of trying to win political power directly, they try to get as many people in Indonesia involved in the party as they can. So they get 25 to 30% of the population either directly in the party or in one of the party's affiliated organizations. And the way that they exercise power is basically through rallies and mass participation. They have no theoretical or practical acceptance of armed struggle. They think that what they need to do is to support Sukarno, put pressure on him, maybe with big protests here and there, prove how many people agree with them, and take the country as a result of that on a more left-leaning path towards capitalist development, but not towards revolution. They were not agitating for some kind of a full communism now. It was very much a long-term project, and they were not unhappy with the way it had been going. And on the other side, you had the right-wing military, which had not, I mean, even I say right-wing, but if you were to look at the way that they spoke up until 1965, they also would use the language of anti-imperialism, of anti-colonial independence, of, so they would use sort of the global language of leftist struggle. But they were anti-communist and they were opposed to the PKI having any power. They repeatedly blocked the PKI from having power. And it was not a coincidence that they were receiving direct assistance from the U.S. while they were acting in this anti-communist way.
So it's around this time that you had the Sino-Soviet split. How does that factor into the decisions of the PKI?
Yeah, so the Sino-Soviet split is interesting because they kind of take both sides in a way. So by the early 1960s, the PKI is the largest communist party outside of Soviet Union and China. So when the Sino-Soviet split actually happens, the PKI does not go with Mao. The PKI officially, technically accepts Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin in 1956. So Mao considers them a quote-unquote revisionist party. They remain orthodox Marxist-Leninists in the very, very old school sense. However, as the 60s develop, Sukarno is insisting upon his right to territorial control over regions that should have been part of Indonesia, he believes, or parts of Malaysia that should not have been decolonized in the way that he believes. So the Soviet Union, as the 60s go on, are very uninterested in Sukarno's fights with Britain over Malaysia, most specifically. But China is willing to lend a little bit of support, not direct support really, but at least, they are much more amenable to these moves that Sukarno takes. So the PKI remains, on the one hand, technically revisionist, in Mao's terminology, but two, not really on good terms with Brezhnev, because Brezhnev is not interested in making waves in Southeast Asia. And three, they have their entire whole thing going, which is to be a mass-based populist party that is going to change society through just the strength of numbers rather than being a vanguard party. They had these kind of strange ideological contortions where they would say they were Leninist, but like, if they were, it was a very, very different type of communist party. And they didn't feel the need to be like those other countries. They were huge. They were doing very well. They had convinced a third of their country to back them at least, and most of the rest of the country that they were fine. You know, they were not they didn't see the need for arms or for to take orders from anyone, really.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Before I'll let my co-host continue on this line of discussion, Aidit, A-I-D-I-T.
Aidit.
Thank you. He was Mao and him talked before 1965 about the lack of left militia in Indonesia, and I felt that kind of tragically paralleled how Fidel Castro approached Allende in the 1970s.
It's very similar, and in both cases, these were leaders that had seen kind of what happens. It's very dark to think about it that way, but you know, like I said, Che Guevara was in Guatemala in 1954 when the coup went much worse than Arbenz thought it would, and people got killed, and there was horrible dictatorship for a very long time afterwards. And Fidel kind of quote unquote learned those lessons that you have to be a little bit more authoritarian or at least defensive.
Well, in a way, Sukarno sort of realized that in so much as that move towards, you know, quote unquote guided democracy after the 58 coup attempt. I guess where I want to go from here is you have Sukarno moving towards this idea of guided democracy, which is a little bit less free, I guess. After the 58 coup, I would say that's, you know, reasonable. You know, you would go into a little bit of crisis mode after a coup attempt. Then we get to September 30th, 1965, and this is the beginning of the real horrific aspect of the book. What happens on September 30th, 1965?
So what happens before is that Howard Jones is removed And Howard Jones is removed as he sees his strategy fall apart. LBJ doesn't want to do this anymore. And they bring in a guy that everybody knows is a coup master. Like, this is the kind of thing that happened in the Cold War all the time. You bring in somebody that is has a reputation for being a regime change ambassador, and they brought in Marshall Green from Korea, who was seen exactly that way. And what we do know about CIA and MI6 activities in the period from Green's arrival to September 30th, 1965, is that both British and U.S. intelligence services wanted to make a clash happen between the left and the right. They were using black propaganda, disinformation, and every tool at their disposal to try to make a clash happen. Again, we don't know what exactly they were doing. This is not yet declassified, but we know that's what they wanted to happen. On September 30th, in a very mysterious way, this is exactly what happens. On the early morning of October 1st, a group calling itself the September 30th Movement sends out, and this is a group with military leadership, they send out groups of soldiers to kidnap seven generals that they say they believe are planning a right-wing coup. Six of these generals end up dead. To this day, no one understands why, if this was an accident, if this was infiltration, if this was planned from the beginning. And immediately, Suharto, who is friends with the leaders of the September 30th movement, but was not targeted by them, even though he was well-known as a right-wing figure, he immediately takes control of the country, immediately shuts down all media that would contradict the propaganda story that he's about to spread. And he tells the whole country that it was actually the communists that were responsible for this. The communists had taken these six heroic generals prisoner. The communist women's organization had performed some kind of an erotic, deviant, satanic Marxist dance and tortured them to death.
These feminists were witches, in other words, according to...
Exactly. It was quite literally the invocation of castration anxiety and the legend of witches to claim that they had cut off the genitals of these heroic generals in some kind of a deranged communist murder orgy. Now, obviously, none of this has happened, but it took us a very long time to even find out that this didn't happen. The extent to which that Suharto established control over the country's media and over the country very quickly is to this day something we don't quite understand. He's not the guy that was supposed to take over. The guy that was supposed to take over is the man Nasution, who I told you earlier said he would never lead a dictatorship. No one can figure out how he came up with this amazingly perfect psychological, this perfectly crafted horror story so quickly. But we do know that right away, as soon as the State Department realizes what's happening, is that they help him do this. And then this propaganda story about the unique evil of the Communist Party turns into, we need to crush the Communist Party, and if you don't help us, you'll be crushed too. And throughout the country in different ways, there are mass arrests or people turning themselves in on the left. And the prisons are filled up with every manner of quote-unquote communists. Some are actual Communist Party members. Some are just members of these other organizations that I referred to earlier, peasants' organizations, teachers' organizations, cultural organizations. And the prisons are filled up with people that think they're just kind of being detained for a bit. But what happens is, in the middle of the night, some of these prisoners are taken out and murdered and thrown into rivers, or their bodies are discarded. Often the executions are carried out not exactly by the military by themselves, but by paramilitary groups that had been formed perhaps during a state period that had been, or that were attached to other political parties, or that were attached to religious groups, depending on which part of the country you were in. This varied. But as a rule, what happened was you were taken from prison in the middle of the night, or sometimes in the day, and somebody stabbed you, strangled you, threw you in a river. That probably wasn't an actual officer, but the officer was overseeing the whole thing. And nobody knew what happened to you. Your family members, I mean, the people that were in jail had a pretty good idea that you left and you never came back. But there was no acknowledgement, certainly not in mainstream Indonesian media, that these killings were taking place. I mean, if you lived close enough to a river, you knew this. But in Jakarta, where there were less killings, it wasn't like the government was saying, oh, yeah, we're executing these people. It was disappearances, as John Russa, the historian, led me to – he pressed me to investigate that angle, and I think he is right, is that these should be considered mass disappearances, not just mass murder. And at every step of the way, the United States praised, encouraged, and assisted this operation. They didn't have to do a lot, though, and this is very important. This is very different from what happened in the 50s in Iran and Guatemala and even the invasion of 58. They didn't, you know, at one point, the CIA office in Bangkok approves the distribution of arms to the military, but they don't need it. They already are the only armed force in the country. They've had 7 years of U.S. training and backing. And so they decide, oh, well, if they need anything, they'll let us know. They're doing a great job on their own. But at one point, we know a member of the State Department's staff hands over lists of people that the military can make sure that they've killed. We know that as the military is killing lots of people and the United States is getting reports of these mass murders, the United States continues to press the military to remove Sukarno and get rid of the left, and they know very well what that means, right? I mean, there's no, as far as I know, there's no declassified file that says kill more people, but while the mass killings are happening, they say, you know, your support is dependent on crushing the left and getting rid of Sukarno. And this goes on not for that long. Within just a matter of months, Indonesia goes from the leader of the anti-imperialist left-leaning third world movement to a quiet, compliant partner of the Cold War order that the United States has constructed.
And this is all done, I believe, under the banner of I believe this was called Operation Annihilation.
Yeah, so that is, I mean, so like Operasi Penumpasan, like that was only uncovered by Australian historian Jess Melvin in the last couple of years. So like it's really striking to me. And so like, you know, I kind of come in as a journalist kind of being like, ah, let's figure this out. And there's this – people have been doing careful scholarly work for 40, 50, 60 years, and they take it for granted that they're not allowed to know what actually happened. And I come in and I'm like, well, why don't we just know? Like why has there not been sufficient pressure on the United States government and the Indonesian government just to show us what actually happened? Because she came across these files on the island of Sumatra just a few years ago that established more forcefully than had been – possible before the extent to which the military really spearheaded the mass killings. For a long time, the official narrative was like, it just kind of happened.
What was the term they used? Wasn't there a brigadier general that used the term "down to the roots"? That's exactly. A very haunting statement.
Down to the roots. So that's Ishak Juarsa, who studied in Kansas. So he, like the other man that used this exact same phrase, Moko Ginta, were both Kansas trained, U.S. Educated army officers. And again, like, we don't know if the mass murder was planned in advance with the help of the United States, if it happened spontaneously because they arrested a lot of people and just decided to just murder them. If that happened spontaneously with U.S. advisement, or if it happened without, and then the U.S. just got excited about what was happening, none of that we know. And I don't think it's like – I'm not satisfied with the task of piecing that together based on scraps. Like, just why is it that this massacre is so deeply memory-holed and so pushed so far to the back – of 20th century history, that we can't just force the parties to show us what actually happened.
And I want to note right here that you know, there's embassy cables coming to the State Department when that leader we mentioned earlier, Ait,
Aidit,
yeah, he's captured, gives a false confession, and they know it's a false confession.
Yep.
At the embassy. Not only that, but I really want to hone.
Well, he doesn't give a false confession. They murder him, and then they just say that he said whatever they want. Yeah.
Right, right. But what I really want to hone in on is, I don't think my listeners, they may not understand the extent of just how bad this mass murder that really starts in October of 65 is. I mean, the PKI was so popular that you couldn't just find all the members. Right. I mean, this was just indiscriminate mass slaughter, you know, just killing as many people as possible. And it's a system of terror to get people to say, oh, I'm just going to back off from all this activism.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. The really dark thing about sort of the Jakarta method, as it's called in the book title, is that as a rule, they didn't kill more people than they needed to. This was effective violence. It was done for a purpose. Like, because killing a lot of people is very hard, and, you know, people don't like doing it. Like, so that there's stories that to get the actual murders to do it, they had to, like, drug them or get them drunk or threaten them, you know. And in the case, the horrible case of Indonesia is that so many of people in the country were on the left, either in the party or somehow affiliated with the party, that killing 1 million people was not even close to everyone that they would have had to kill if they were going to kill every leftist, right? But 1 million people was enough to get that 25 to 30% of the country to not ever talk about it ever again, right? So the point of it was not to kill every single leftist in the country, because to do that, you'd have to get rid of a third of the country. That would be not only obvious to the rest of the world, it would destroy your country, right? But with the 1 million or 500,000 or 3 million, the numbers vary, with the amount that they disappeared in this short period of time, very brutally and very, very in a very complete way establishing that they were in charge, to this day, everybody else will not talk about their political activity. So, except for the very rare cases of the survivors that I were able to meet and get to know well enough that they wanted to talk, as a rule, anybody that lived in Indonesia in 1962 will not tell you what their political. They'll tell, oh, I didn't know anything. But because the possibility of being labeled as a communist to this day is so powerful in Indonesia that everybody just let Suharto win. You know, Suharto, he proved his point. He's in charge now.
And at the same time in the U.S., I mean, I think there's an inkling in the U.S. at this time that this is, you know, very brutal, you know, slaughter, mass slaughter of people. The term that haunted me was that one writer who referred to it as the savage transformation. He was saying it in like this positive sense. It's absolutely horrifying.
Yeah, James Reston, who is a like famous liberal columnist at the New York Times.
Yeah, it's at this point that I think we finally get the title screen, like the Jakarta method, the lesson has been learned, and now it's in applying it.
Yeah.
But before we close out, I guess we've covered the actual violence that occurred in Indonesia. How, though, does this extend into the rest of the world? How does the specter of Jakarta extend into places like Santiago, Chile?
Yeah, so there's two ways, right? So although we've totally forgotten about it, this was a hugely important event in 1965. Everybody on the left and the right was looking to Indonesia. This is the largest communist party outside of Soviet Union, China. And two waves sort of are formed by this horrible explosion of violence, and they go off in different directions. On the left, a lot of people come to the conclusion, oh, we need to arm or else we'll get killed. And the Cultural Revolution in China might be some way related to this phenomenon. Certainly the Philippine Communist Party, certainly Pol Pot, certainly Latin American leftists all came to the conclusion, oh, no, we need to get hardcore or else we're going to die. Now, on the other side of the political spectrum, Washington's real potential or already allies on the anti-communist right, they saw how big of a success this was. And they saw that you could get away with it. It was not only something that worked to take power, as long as you just told Washington that you believed in liberty or whatever afterwards, you never got punished. You were accepted into the group of nations which was favored by the hegemon. And so in Brazil and Chile in the early 70s, you get the appearance of this word Jakarta, which is meant to signify mass violence as something that we might do. And in both cases, they do it. So under Allende, it's a threat that is plastered on the houses of supporters of the government or people that work in the government. In Brazil, it's a secret operation which was never really confirmed. We only know from secondhand reports that was maybe called that. But it means we're going to kill you. And when the CIA eventually succeeds in removing Allende in 1973, the Jakarta does come. They do kill the people that they have threatened, and this includes the husband of one of the people I got to know for this book, Carmen Hertz. And again, they were also right. You know, if by looking to Indonesia they came to the conclusion that they could get away with this kind of stuff, they were absolutely right. If by looking at Indonesia they concluded that the Jakarta method was effective, they were absolutely right. These regimes, shaped life in South America to a large extent to this day. And of course, the United States did not turn around and say that, Chile, you can't do this. They assisted in the creation of Operation Condor, which was a international murder mechanism in South America, and the member countries of Operation Condor killed tens of thousands of people, and then the member countries of Operation Condor helped train right-wing death squads in Central America, which killed hundreds of thousands of people. And until the end of the Cold War, this was a fundamental part of the way that the right, and that the right, of course, being the side that the U.S. is on, fought the Cold War.
That's so chilling that, plastered across walls in Santiago, there were just the words, Jakarta is coming. It's such a scary threat when you realize what happened in Indonesia. And later on, when you talk about the Contras in El Salvador, you have that one major whose name I will not pronounce because I will just completely butcher it. But he says, you can be a communist without actually being a communist.
Oh, yeah, you can be a communist even though you think you are not a communist.
Right, right. It harkens back to that sort of death trap logic of Hoover.
Yeah, and he killed Oscar Romero, the El Salvadorian priest that was speaking out slightly too loudly about the abuses of the dictatorship. So in Jakarta, I traded emails with the guy that I believe oversaw this operation. He didn't want to talk about it. So he does give interviews now. He's willing to talk about what Patria and Libertad was doing back in Chile in the 70s. And I got confirmation from a few of his friends at the time that it was probably him that did it. But when I told him what I wanted to talk about, he clammed up. He said, nobody in Chile cares about Jakarta. And I was like, oh, well, that might be the case, but this is sort of it's the title of my book, so it's bringing together these strands. So I am interested in the interview was off. So I think it is as chilling as you say it is, and it was so chilling that even the guy who did it, and even though he's kind of proud of his other activities, my guess is that I found the guy that did it, and he just didn't. It was something that he doesn't want to be associated with him, even though it was too chilling even for him, I think.
In that regard, I guess I have to ask, I'm assuming that if a National Review person read this book, they would cry a foul and say, oh, Vincent Bevins is not covering the Stalinist purges and blah, 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 blah. How would you respond to them? Because I think the end of the book gives a pretty good response to why you hone in on this Jakarta method, as you call it.
Yeah, well, number one, I think I do actually sort of affirm every major crime committed by communist regimes in the 20th century, but they're not the focus of the book. And the reason they're not the focus in the book is a couple reasons. One is that the Soviet Union is over. It's gone. Very few people defend it, and it has not, it does not exercise power over people's lives. On the contrary, we live very much in a world created by pro-capitalist violence. We live very much in a world that was shaped by the Jakarta Method and shaped by the mass murder programs that I outline in this book. And we have not recognized the extent to which we live in a world shaped by that violence. It's unresolved and forgotten, and if it's not confronted, it will continue to exercise influence over us. And the third issue is just that for the people whose stories that I followed, that, you know, all of the people that are in this book, it's just the Soviet Union just was not involved. There was, they were not doing any crimes, and they were not going to do crimes if the CIA had not taken this path. It just was a very different part of history that was not actually relevant to these stories. But I think that the reason that a book needed to be written that highlights this other side of the coin is because it's still, you know, the very chair that I sit on, you know, is the product of a system shaped by this violence. And it's just the opposite is just not the case for Stalin.
What's interesting, too, with regards to how this book looks at the Cold War, I think most of us look at the Soviet Union's as the losers, right? They're the losers of the Cold War, and America are the great winners. But, you know, in a very ironic way, a very tragic way, the real losers of the 20th century are those who believed so strongly in the liberal international order and democracy within this Third World movement that they had to be annihilated by the very country, with the help of the very country, America, the U.S., that claimed to have been for this kind of liberal international order and this kind of strengthening of democracy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union did not fare well after 1989, but I think that I was the one, you know, over the last 3 years, I think I was hanging out with the real losers of the Cold War. And these are the left-wing movements in the Third World that were crushed precisely because they were unarmed. They were crushed precisely because they thought if they played by the rules, everything would be fine. And have been thrown fully into the dustbin of history, to use that old phrase from the Soviet Union. Like, the people in Indonesia, like, not only did they lose, like, they lost the story too. They're considered the bad guys.
It's in a way, it's a double death, right? Because, right. I mean, you have the actual violence, and then you have the complete erasure of the historical memory of that violence. It's sort of, it reminds me of the Armenian genocide. Not only do you have this genocide that happened, but to this very day, I mean, there's people who still deny that genocide. I mean, that in itself is a horror story.
Yeah, and this is something that, when I was going back and forth between Indonesia and Latin America for these stories, and I would tell the Indonesians about, oh, well, in Latin America, this one victim is now involved in politics. And they're like, what? I mean, they're allowed to be involved in politics? The people in Indonesia are just, like, shocked that they have, down here in South America, most countries have gone through a reconciliation process where people have received apologies, and the record has been set straight to say, you were not wrong. The dictatorship was wrong. We're going to publish the crimes that were committed by them. In Indonesia, they were shocked that this was even be possible, because they'd given up on this years ago, the possibility that anybody would ever recognize what happened to them.
In closing, the last thing I want to ask, and it's sort of a two-parter, I hope you can answer it, is what story stands out the most for you of the people that you spoke to? And also, do you think investigating this, What was the personal effect that it had on you?
I'm going to do the second one first so I can think about the first one. I feel guilty even saying this, but because, like, what I went through was like 1% of the people that I met over the last 3 years, but it was a very psychologically difficult process, right? Like, there was points in which, like, my kind of sense of self kind of fell apart. I had some, like, real episodes where it was very hard to hear these stories and hard to reconstruct the stories in a way that was faithful. And it made me like sort of just really question the nature of American hegemony, the nature of the global system, the nature of history, nature of human knowledge. And I'm still like emerging from that process and trying to put together like what, trying to come to, you know, trying to figure out what I really think about the world and what I really think about politics in the United States and the global capitalist order.
I ask that question mainly because I've talked to Greg Polgrain, who you talked to for this book, and also Professor Peter Dill Scott, who you reference in the footnotes, and both of them seem to have been very affected by looking into this stuff. It's very devastating type stuff.
Yeah, no, it was very, it was like a hole I had to kind of climb. I mean, I also went into kind of isolation on purpose because I was, you know, I was living in Indonesia. I was just writing fully by myself. And I had to like move back to London where like my friends live and like learn how to like interact with, you know, and like my first interactions with my friends back in London, they were like, what are you talking about? Cause I was like, oh, nobody in this city does real work. They just like have fake jobs so that they can justify receiving the spoils of empire. And even my friends on the left in London were like, what is this idea? Like, what are you like a Maoist third worldist or something now? I was like, no, but like, you don't understand. Like what do these people do? They're just like typing on computers and they get like the labor of thousands of people in the underdeveloped world. Like obviously this is the product of violence and everything. And all this privilege is a product of violence. And like, I'm not like, I might believe that's true. I might not. But whether or not it's true, it's very hard to exist, to keep that thought in your head and also just live in the world at the same time. So I think I'm still sort of putting back together what I really think about the nature of the global system. And I guess like the person that I like, you know, I guess I kind of made her the hero of the story is Francisca is the person that affected me the most because she was a part, she experienced Japanese occupation. She fought to expel the Dutch after the end of World War II. She was involved in the Third World Movement, translating a bunch of different languages, traveling around the world, trying to like create this movement of journalism by the Third World for the Third World. Her husband's killed in 1965. She retreats to Amsterdam with her family. Her husband is not killed in 1965. He's taken into prison and never comes out. But still, she's 94 years old and she's like fighting every day to like set the record straight. She's like reading voraciously to try to understand what happened and to try to get the word out. And like, she's lived like 10 lives, you know, lived enough for 10 people, where I come from, but still like never gave up on this idea of her country being something that she's proud of and, telling this, the truth about what really happened. And even though she hasn't succeeded yet in 94 years, she keeps going. So I think that was probably
The one that gets me, if I could real quick, and then we'll let you go, is you had one of the heads of the organizations for survivors of the Indonesian violence, and you asked them, well, you know, what about the Cold War? Who won it? And he said, you know, the U.S. won, capitalism won. And you ask him, well, how? And he just responds, you killed us. I mean, this is a very difficult read in a lot of ways, but I think this is one of the most important books to come out this year. I want to thank you for writing it. And if you want, how can my listeners get the book? And if there's anything you want to say in regards to what do you want them to get out of it? What do you want readers to get out of it? Because I know you're not saying that this is the reason that the U.S. won the Cold War, but you view it as
it's part of victory. It's part of the way. It's not the reason that the victory was in a binary sense ours versus theirs, but it was a part of the way the victory happened and it shaped what that victory meant. They could buy the book. Anywhere that people normally buy books is great. If you're in the US, like my personal website, I set up a little page called just at thejakartamethod.com, which has sort of ways you can buy it to avoid Amazon. Or get it abroad if you like. And I do hope people buy it, not because I'm going to get the money myself. I'm not going to get any more money for this. But if sales tick in the system, it sends a signal to the publishing industry that the book should be taken seriously or translated or pushed by the industry. But really, I'm looking forward to having other people read it and seeing what they make of the whole story, because it is not a story with, like, I didn't tell the story so that people would think X. It's not a story constructed in the service of a moral. It is just what happened, and I'm just as eager myself to figure out what it might mean as anybody else that might be reading it.
Do you think there's a possibility, I know we talked about Bolsonaro at the beginning, do you think there's a possibility that history could repeat itself? I mean, we've talked about Operation Condor, the Phoenix Program, the massacres in Indonesia. Do you think this kind of violence could happen again?
Yeah. I mean, so I don't think that Bolsonaro is probably in a position right now to consolidate that kind of dictatorial control and carry out those kinds of massacres, just because he's politically weak at the moment. But it's possible. Well, it could be possible with Bolsonaro. But what I will definitely tell you is that every time that I met a victim, whether it was Brazil or Indonesia or Chile, that experienced a sudden eruption of violence that took their friends or loved ones away from them, they always were operating as if it was impossible. They were always operating as if, quote unquote, those kinds of things don't happen anymore. But obviously, they do. I don't think the history works the way that we've sort of received an understanding in the Western liberal world. Like, there are no lines drawn in the sand where, like, oh, that's over forever and history has advanced past this thing. Anything could happen. And
the Fukuyama view of history may not exactly be correct, the end of history.
Well, sir, yeah, certainly the popularly accepted interpretation of whatever that meant is not quite right. I like, there's no lines in the sand. History does not arc towards anything. The arc of history does not necessarily bend in any way. And like I said, I spent the last 3 years getting to know people that thought it could never happen to them. And it did.
Well, thank you again, Vincent Bevins, author of The Jakarta Method, for coming on Parallax Views.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you found our conversation with Vincent Bevins, author of The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade, and the Mass Murder Program that Shaped Our World, to be extremely informative. I cannot stress enough how important, how significant I feel that this book is. If you haven't got a copy of The Jakarta Method yet, well, you need to rectify that as soon as possible. I cannot recommend it highly enough. So please, if you can, get a copy of The Jakarta Method by Vincent Bevins. You will not be disappointed. This is an extremely worthwhile read if you want to understand history and the moment we are in today, the moment the world is in today. It's a very, very powerful and profound read. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. And of course, if you can, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Could really use your support. You, the listener, are what keep this show going. So I really need your help. Been trying to push for more subscribers, releasing a lot of bonus content, including video interviews, the Week That Was current events show, and more. Oh, and hey, you also get archived editions of Parallax Views that are now only available for Patreon supporters. So keep that in mind, and please consider supporting me on patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, You've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.